From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You know the story of David and Goliath, the one in the Bible, shepherd kid takes on a giant. Well, Malcolm Gladwell says almost everything about the way we've told that story over the years is wrong. The story is at the heart of his latest book called, well, David and Goliath. Gladwell says if you really look at these kinds of lopsided conflicts, the David and Goliaths in history in your local newspaper, you'll see they're not really all that rare. And in fact, being the little guy is a good thing. He says facing overwhelming odds in life can produce greatness and beauty. Malcolm Gladwell was in Utah yesterday, and we had a chance to talk to him about his latest book, but also his life and his process for making dry statistics and research come to life. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's been said that Malcolm Gladwell has created his own literary genre. His articles in The New Yorker, and now with his 5 best-selling books, Gladwell takes big ideas from science and academics and finds stories to give them life, or, as he himself has put it, to get people to look at the world a little differently. The British journalist Deborah Ross says he takes crunching, dry, complex material and turns it into engaging, irresistible stories. She says he may be like the writer Bill Bryson, but more so and with crazier hair. Gladwell describes his genre as intellectual adventure stories. And today in the program, we're talking to him about his latest, called David and Goliath. Malcolm Gladwell is in Utah this week, a guest of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. He's here to give the inaugural speech in the Sam Rich Speaking Series. And he's joining us today in the caucus room at Hinckley, here on the campus of the University of Utah, to talk about his new book and some other things. Malcolm Gladwell is a journalist. He's an author. He's been a staff writer with The New Yorker magazine since 1996. Time magazine, we should mention, named him one of the 100 most influential people. He's on Foreign Policy magazine's top global thinkers of 2010. And his latest book, I mentioned, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. And Malcolm Gladwell, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Well, I wanted to begin with the story that's, of course, at the heart of the book, a closer look at the story of David and Goliath in the Bible. And you've talked about how when you first encountered this story, I guess it was the story we all came to know, but you say as you explored it, the more you explored it, your understanding of it radically changed. Would you talk about that?
It actually was incredibly, was one of the most fun things I did with the book, was to start reading in the scholarly literature around that story. And the first thing that you find out is that David's weapon, the sling, is not a child's toy. It's one of the most devastating weapons in ancient times. And there's a fascinating paper written by a ballistics expert with the Israeli Defense Force who calculates that the rock propelled from David's sling would have had stopping power equal to a bullet fired from a .45 caliber handgun. This is a exceedingly lethal weapon he has in his hands. And then is the fact that there's all this fascinating speculation among endocrinologists about Goliath.
Yeah.
Because in the biblical story of Samuel, there's all of these weird little hints that everything is not as it seems with Goliath. He's led down onto the valley floor for his showdown with David by an attendant, a shield carrier, which makes no sense. First of all, he's the mightiest warrior in the land. Why does he need someone to lead him by the hand into the... Secondly, why does he need a shield carrier? The shield carriers were typically employed to accompany archers because archers had both of their hands employed in their bow and arrow, right? So they couldn't protect themselves. So you had a boy carry a body shield to protect. Goliath is not an archer. Right. Why does he have this? And then there's the fact that why on earth does it take Goliath forever to respond to David? David comes down the mountain dressed in a shepherd's tunic, carrying a staff, and that's it. He's not in armor. He's not carrying a sword. It's supposed to be a sword fight. Yeah. What is up with Goliath, right? And then Goliath keeps saying, come to me, you know, so I might, you know, give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. And he says that a second time. And why is he so insistent that David come to him? Well, the endocrinologists say Goliath probably had a condition called acromegaly, which is a tumor on your pituitary gland, which causes excess production of human growth hormone, which would account for his size. In fact, giants are often afflicted with acromegaly. It would also account for his strange behavior, because one of the side effects of acromegaly is the tumor gets so large it compresses your optic nerves and your vision is impaired. Goliath can't see much beyond a few feet in front of him.
Right.
That explains everything. So here we have this big lumbering giant weighed down with 100 pounds of armor who can't see much beyond the front of his face, confronted with this kid who has changed the rules and has superior technology, right? Why is David the underdog? Oh, by the way, I haven't even mentioned the most important fact. David is filled with the Spirit of the Lord. I mean,
right.
In no sense is this guy the underdog in this battle. So I don't know why we have insisted on telling the story as if it's this improbable victory by, you know, totally out of left field. Who would have thunk? Well, I'm sorry, everyone would have thought, given, you know, an accurate knowledge of that showdown.
You've talked about how you believe the people who first wrote this story had a pretty sophisticated understanding of it.
If you read the sort of, the rabbis have written extensively on this story,
yeah,
and affiliated theologians over the years. And there is, in some of the commentaries on the story, there's a kind of knowingness to their account of, the account of Goliath being led onto the valley floor by a shield bearer. That's shield bearer in quotes. It's like, yeah, right. They sort of knew something was up with this guy.
Yeah.
So there is that suggestion. There's a little bit of mockery of Goliath in the telling of the story, which would go along with the fact that to his contemporaries, David wasn't this, you know, outlandish upstart. He was someone playing a pretty kind of, I mean, once he changed the rules, they were well aware that he had the upper hand. You know, slingers were part of every army in ancient times, which is what David is. He's a guy with a sling. They employed them to do battle with heavy infantry, which is what Goliath was. So this idea of using a sling against a big armored guy is part of the military strategy of the time.
So why is it that we've come to this explanation of it now? Do you think you have the answer to why we like to think of the story the way we do, as opposed to in that more complicated way?
Because we have a weird set of, and this is really what the book's about, that we have a weird set of intuitive biases about advantages. We can't get it out of our head that the guy who's really, really strong and big has to be called the favorite. And that the kid who has outthought him and is really nimble has to be thought of as somehow in second place. I don't know. I can't do better than that. But in the book, I sort of try to give repeated examples of how we jump to conclusions about what the advantageous situation is. And very often, that's simply not the case. We just don't seem to be good at navigating this question.
You talked about how the book is also about power. And this is the part that seems, one of the parts, because there are a lot of parts that seem kind of counterintuitive, in the sense that the power or the conventions of society, the point you're making in the book, they have their limitations.
Power is really limited. I mean, if you just think back to Goliath, there's a trade-off with Goliath. He is heavily armed, has 100 pounds of armor and a big heavy sword and a javelin and a spear. The trade-off is he can't move,
yeah,
right? And that's a trade-off that's true of everyone who is large and strong. Has that disadvantage that they are going in certain situations where nimbleness and adaptability is called for, they're not going to do as well. You know, what happened in Vietnam to the United States of America? Well, Goliath encountered David and fought a battle on a battlefield where nimbleness and audacity counted for more than size and strength. So it happens all the time in the world. It, you know, when Microsoft goes up against some nimble little software company from Provo. Just threw that out there to get in better with all you guys. You know, and that little company from Provo, when they eat Microsoft lunch, it's because there are certain circumstances when the things that the startup has, hunger, motivation, when the startup is forced to innovate, to be on the cutting edge, because if they don't, they'll go out of business. Microsoft has none of those compulsions, right? There are going to be instances, not all instances, where the advantage goes to the little guy, the hungry little guy, right? So this happens all the time in our lives. And I just wanted to do a more systematic accounting of these seeming paradoxes.
When did the idea come to you? Was it the story of David and Goliath, or was it the idea of advantage and power first, and then you found, you know, how did it work? Do you remember?
Well, I always forget where the ideas for my stories come from, first of all. So I'm going to give you an answer, but it's almost certainly a lie. Let's just preface that by saying I'm making it up just to satisfy this particular situation that we're in. So it's possible that it was with the story about the basketball coach.
Yeah.
For those of you who haven't read the book, there's this chapter where that's about this Indian guy, that is to say a guy from India, who is a software mogul in Silicon Valley and coaches his daughter's 12-year-old basketball team and knows nothing about basketball, so does his homework and goes to watch basketball games and comes away convinced that Americans are crazy. They are playing the game all wrong.
Yeah.
As only a cricket fan from Mumbai could conclude. And he decides that he doesn't understand why you wouldn't play the full court press every minute of every game, particularly if your team isn't any good. Because his perspective is, if your team is lousy, you will never win if you run back on defense, because you're letting the other team, which is better than you, do the thing that makes them better than you. And because his team, that when he looks at them, his group of 12-year-old girls, who are all the daughters of computer programmers. Now, I'll let your imagination fill in the blanks on how good they are.
Yeah.
let's just say they don't come home and shoot baskets for 3 hours every night.
Yeah.
His team's terrible. So he's like, my team's so bad, we can't play the normal way. So he says to them, look, we're not going to practice shooting, dribbling, or passing. It's pointless. There's no way you guys are ever going to get up to snuff. We're just going to practice this crazy defense.
Yeah.
So they play this maniacal defense and nothing else. And by the way, he uses his entire... It's so hilarious. Because no one's any good, he doesn't have... Why would he... The concept of a starter doesn't exist. He plays all of them equally, and because it's so exhausting. Anyway, so he goes all the way to the national championships is the short answer to the question. And I thought the story, what he told me, was so deeply hilarious. Because along the way, of course, he earns the enmity of every opposing coach, because his girls, they're winning games by scores like 8-0, which, because as it turns out, if you play maniacal full court defense against another team of 12-year-old girls, the other team of 12-year-old girls will not get the ball across midcourt.
Yeah.
You can't advance. It's hard enough to break the press in the pros.
Right.
But if you're 12, you're not going to break the press. In fact, the game no longer resembles basketball.
Right.
6-0's not a basketball score.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So, but of course, he doesn't care. He doesn't know what basketball is supposed to look like. So he has this...
And the other parents are furious. He almost gets beaten up in the parking lot.
But again, he has no stake in...
Right.
He's from Mumbai.
Yeah.
6-0 seems fine to him. So he's this beautiful example of an underdog, because one of the things underdogs do is they are obnoxious, right? The formal word is disagreeable.
Disagreeable.
They break the rules because they have no choice.
Yeah.
Right? This is this beautiful and also unsettling thing that those without access to formal authority do. I thought that story was so lovely that I think that's how I got the idea for the book.
You know, what's interesting about that idea of the full court press is, as you say, the puzzle is why more don't do it. And one of the reasons, as you say, is because it doesn't resemble basketball if you do it. But you find that there's this pattern that goes like this. You write about this in the book, that most of the time when an underdog fights like David, when they go against convention, when they do their own rules, They usually win. But most of the time, underdogs don't fight like David. And you talk about George Washington, for example. When he fights like David, when he uses guerrilla warfare, they kick butt.
Yeah.
But then for some reason they pull back, and that was a pattern use.
George Washington nearly squanders the American Revolution.
Yeah.
And you should know that as I talk about this, that I am a Canadian, born in England, and so I take the opposite side.
Right. Okay. Good.
So when I say that he nearly squandered it, my heart is beating with a kind of excitement and anticipation. He does this thing, which is very typical, that he's making an enormous headway fighting guerrilla style, and then he decides what he really wants to do is fight the British straight up, and he nearly throws it away. And this is sort of this weird thing that it's hard to play by David's rules. We're always tugged towards convention.
Yeah.
And
you have to be desperate is one of the things you say.
You have to be desperate, yeah. I mean, it's why the subtitle says Underdogs and Misfits, that so many of the people whose stories I tell in the book are really misfits. They are people who are damaged in some way. Mm. And it's their damage that permits them to do these disagreeable, uncomfortable, obnoxious things. And there's a kind of beauty in that. It makes you understand why we need, in this strange way, need damaged people in the world.
You've written that as a child you weren't much of a joiner. You quit the Boy Scouts after something like a week.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, is that the thing, part of that anyway, that contrary nature, is that something that it helps explain your work in some way, your affection to certain ideas and stories?
Wow, I had not thought to link my quitting with the Boy Scouts to...
I can't believe you haven't, actually.
No, that's interesting. It's intriguing. I was trying to think back to why I quit. Well, I think the reason I quit the Boy Scouts is that conceptually it made no sense to me. That my understanding of my peers at that age is that, with the exception of my best friend Bruce, they weren't terribly either pleasant or interesting people.
Right.
And so the idea that you would willingly go and sort of go away for weekends with large groups of kids your age was just so fantastically bizarre to me. So am I a little bit antisocial, possibly? Is this why I'm attracted to strange ideas? Well, certainly in my family, the notion of fitting in was considered to be overrated. At no time in my father's life has he ever even remotely tried to fit in. Well, first of all, my father, a white Englishman, marries my mother, a black woman, in 1958.
Yeah. In England.
In England. That's not a fitting in strategy.
right.
I remember him being a kid. We grew up in Mennonite country in southern Ontario. And there were old order Mennonites like the Amish. They would have barn raisings. And I remember my father deciding that he wanted to go to a barn raising. My father is a mathematician who at that stage in his life spoke with a profoundly English accent and wore ties at all times, even on the weekends. He got in his Peugeot with his three sons, drove to an Amish barn raising where everyone else came by horse and buggy, and walked up with his English accent and his tie and chipped in. Now, again, you don't do that if you're interested in fitting in. So a whole childhood is just basically one example of another of my father sticking out like a sore thumb in whatever. And I think I just consider that normal, I guess, maybe.
I read somewhere where you didn't watch television or weren't allowed to watch television.
Oh, we didn't have one.
Didn't have a television. So is this the practical thing? Not that there was some objection.
Oh, I would have watched it if we had one.
Of course, but your parents weren't objecting to popular culture or anything like that?
I think they probably were on some level. It was never articulated. Huh. There were lots of things we didn't have. I think it was considered to be kind of lazy to have a TV. Also, this is Canada in the 70s. I'm not sure there was anything to watch on television.
Right.
So, I don't know whether we were missing much. Bonanza, perhaps. We didn't really have... maybe we were a little weird. I don't know. We didn't ever go out to eat. We didn't have a stereo. We didn't have a television. We never went to the movies. Ever. We went to one movie growing up. That was... I didn't go. I stayed home with my mother. My brothers went with my dad. It was Fiddler on the Roof.
Wow.
To this day, that movie has a kind of oversized importance in the kind of psychic world of my family.
Right.
My mother subsequently saw another movie, but it was on an airplane with the sound off. It was only the second movie she'd seen in about 25 years. And she speaks about that movie like it's Citizen Kane.
Right.
I think it was like some dumb rom-com, you know? Like,
yeah, yeah.
But she was like, oh, it was... She called it a film. And I said, Mom, did you get the headset? She goes, well, it's $2.
So what was the expectation? Did it matter to your parents what you did? I mean, did they say, we want you to do something important with your life? Or was it stated?
No, my parents... I'm the youngest of three.
Yeah.
And my parents, by the time I'd come along, had just given up on the whole, you know, as parents do when number three and four and five come along.
Yeah.
They stopped at three, but this trend would have accelerated had they had more.
Right.
I think they had just, there are no pictures of me. And they had ceased to parent by the time. I stopped going to high school in my third year of high school. Because my mother very brilliantly realized that if she simply said yes to anything I wanted to do, I would never rebel. There was nothing to rebel against.
Yeah.
So I informed my mother that I was going to go to high school. And she said, oh, okay. And then she gave me a stack of notes with the date left. They would say, Malcolm is, you know, excused from school today. And I would just fill in the date. And then so disabled any radical or, you know, rebellious impulse that I would dutifully do all my schoolwork, but I just did it at home.
Right.
So I was like the most studious truant probably in the history.
Studious dropout.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my friend Terry, he also didn't go to school with me. And his mother did the same thing. So we would essentially go to the library, you know, instead of doing something truly radical.
When did you start writing? I mean, I'd read about a zine that you helped publish. Was this in high school or was this in
Terry,
college?
This guy Terry and I and my friend Bruce, there were three of us in this little country school in the middle of nowhere. We published a zine called Ad Hominem.
Yeah.
And the rule was that every article had to have a personal attack on someone. It's called A Journal of Slander and Critical Opinion. I remember this. And every third issue, we would stop and put out a greatest hits issue, which we thought was hilarious. And then the big cost was photocopying because, you know, we were 15. Who had money? Photocopying was expensive in the 70s in Canada. I mean, so we had to hit up various people for contributions to get it to do photocopying. But yeah, we did have this magazine for about 2 years. And then I wrote a little bit in college. I couldn't get on the student newspaper. So instead, I wrote these... no one went to the football games at my college. And so my friend Bruce and I... Literally, when I say no one, I mean no one went. So we would write these accounts of the football games. And because we knew no one went, we just would make them up. So we invented the coach. We called, we said it was a guy named Wexford Harding. And he was this from Alabama, and he had a drinking problem. And so we had this whole, and then by the end of the football season, we had these long, elaborate articles about Wexford Harding, who would always have waxed nostalgic about, you know, Crimson Tide games from the 60s, and he would, you know, fall off the wagon. I mean, it was this whole thing. And I think to this day there are people who think that our college football team had a coach called Wexford Harding. My writing up until the end of college was really only in the realm of either invective or fantasy.
Malcolm Gladwell. His latest book is called David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. We recorded our conversation at the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics. Gladwell was in Utah to deliver the inaugural lecture in the Sam Rich Lecture Series. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting our conversation with Malcolm Gladwell. Gladwell was in Utah yesterday, guest of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. He spoke last night at Abravanel Hall in Salt Lake City. Gladwell joined us yesterday in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute to talk about writing, which of course includes best-selling books like Blink and The Tipping Point and Outliers. Gladwell describes his work as telling intellectual adventure stories, so we talked to him about his latest, his book just out called David and Goliath. It's a story he says most of us get completely wrong.
There's another question that you get it in this book, and that is, should I persevere or should I give up? You write about how conventional wisdom suggests that a disadvantage is a bad thing. It's something you want to kind of stay away from. But you tell some stories in the book about this theory called desirable difficulties.
Yeah.
I wanted you to talk about that. It's a concept developed by these two psychologists in UCLA, which you describe, I love how you describe it, as a beautiful and haunting way of understanding how underdogs can come to excel. Talk about desirable difficulties.
Yeah, I love that phrase. So this is this idea that the Bjorks, the psychologists at UCLA who've come up with this idea, their notion, they're really interested in learning. And their question is, normally our thought is, if I make the task that I want you to learn, the problem I want you, the thing I want you to learn, if I make the task more difficult, I will impair your ability to learn it, right? It's harder to learn calculus from a badly written calculus textbook from one that is written clearly and simply.
Yeah, right.
That makes sense. And they say, yeah, that makes sense. Except there are exceptions to this. There are instances where if I make the task of learning harder, you will learn better. So they have done experiments, really beautiful experiments on this. For example, if you are if you're studying for three tests, the easiest way to study for three tests is to study, do all your studying for the first, then all for the second, then all for the third, right? They say that's actually not the best way to do it. The best way is to make the process of studying harder. Study one for 10 minutes, then the second for 10 minutes, then the third for 10 minutes, then loop back. Each time you loop back, you're going to have to, you'll be disoriented. You'll have to say, now, where was I again? Find the place, remember all the stuff you'd forgotten, get situated. That's harder, that's going to take longer, but you will learn it far more profoundly than if you take the easy route. That's a simple example of this idea. Well, you can play with this idea in larger and larger contexts. And what I'm interested in is, are there major life events that can be desirable difficulties? So I looked at dyslexia. Dyslexia is a classic example. For most dyslexics, dyslexia is an undesirable difficulty. It makes their life more complicated, and it doesn't help them in any, put them farther ahead. But that is not true of all dyslexics. There's this weird fact that very high percentage of successful entrepreneurs have dyslexia. And so I went around and talked to as many of them as I could find. And virtually all of them will tell you that their dyslexia has been a blessing, that they succeeded not in spite of it, but because of it, that the fact of, the act of trying to come up with workarounds for their inability to read well made them better off than they would have been otherwise.
David Boies is an example. You tell his story. He grows up in rural Illinois, I guess it was, comes to California with his family, becomes a construction worker. His wife says, after they have the baby, look, you've got to get serious about it. And he has dyslexia. I mean, he has this. And he ends up being one of the most famous trial lawyers in the country, in the world, because of this idea of compensating.
Yeah.
And I like it. You talk about one of the keys to this was he learns to listen. Mm-hmm. And he develops this incredible memory, I guess it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So think about it. You're in school and you can't read. So the thing, school requires really that above all other things in the beginning. So you're a little kid, you can't do that. So you have two routes. The route that many dyslexics take is they fail.
Yeah.
Right? He doesn't. What does he do? Well, he does a number of things, but one of the things he does is, first of all, he understands that, oh, if I listen really closely to what the teacher says, I can probably get 80% of what I need to know, right? And then if I commit it to memory, I'll never have to read the textbook. And that strategy, if your memory is, if you really, really, really develop your memory, and if your listening skills are really, really, really good, actually can get you through. So he makes it, he muddles through, and then he gets to, and he muddles through university, and then he gets to law school. And now, you know, if you think about what is a law school lecture? Well, you have a legal expert, a professor, giving a lecture, a real lecture, not just a, you know, lesson in class, but a learned, erudite, complicated presentation of the issues on the table. And what most people in that law school class will do is sort of listen, take some notes, and then go home and read other stuff to sort of get up to speed. He realizes, I can get almost everything I need from this if I'm really, really good at this. So he takes those skills of listening and remembering into the courtroom, and all of a sudden, he's ferocious, right? He's the guy who can, on day five of cross-examination, can say to you, wait a minute, on day one, you said ba-da-ba-da-ba-da, and that contradicts it. Because he's been doing that his whole life. And it's a beautiful example of, it's a profoundly difficult strategy. But if you can pull it off, you're going to be way ahead.
I wanted to ask you about this form of writing. I mentioned you describe it as intellectual adventure stories. But from time to time, you encounter, you know, a critic who will say that you weren't, you know, rigorous enough in the way you presented a bit of research, or that you overinterpreted it, or whatever. And lately, you've sort of stayed away from that for the most part. But lately, you've started responding, and I wanted to talk to you about that. You've written that there are two types of people who read your books: those who read them to review them, and the rest of us. Talk about that, because it seems like the sense that some critics who say, look, he missed an element in a study or something like that are kind of missing the point.
Yeah, you know, look, the thing that I meet people who read my books all the time, and they all have one thing in common, and that is when they read a book, their goal is to enjoy themselves. They don't really have any other... They can't think of another reason why you would read a book. Yeah. And by enjoy, I mean they like to do what I like to do, which is to play with ideas. And sometimes do I overinterpret ideas? Of course. That's part of the fun. You don't have to... And the other thing that my readers, if I talk to them, they don't buy everything in my book. Part of the fun is you say, that's really convincing. That, yeah, you know. I mean, it's part of the process of engagement that you enter into the spirit of adventure, and you draw your own conclusions. And lots and lots and lots of people like doing that, except for a small group of people who happen to review books for major East Coast intellectual publications.
Right.
Who for some reason are, I don't know, are they threatened by that? I have no idea. There's a woman who reviews for the New York Times named Janet Maslin. She reviewed Blink and didn't like it. Then she reviewed Outliers, the book that came after that, and didn't like it. And then she reviewed David and Goliath and didn't like it. Now, my question is, after you've read two of my books and didn't like them, there is a reasonable expectation you're not going to like the third. Right. So why would you put yourself through that misery? My heart went out to this poor woman who is suffering through David and Goliath when history has shown her this is not going to be a pleasant experience. And it's like my father really, really hated liver. And every time he was go to someone's house and was served liver, I could just see his kind of self crumbling and the, you know, the pain etched in his face. And that's what came to mind when I read Janet Maslin's review of David and Goliath. People shouldn't have to put themselves through that kind of discomfort and misery.
You wrote this. You wrote, good writing does not succeed or fail on the strength of its ability to persuade. It succeeds or fails on the strength of its ability to engage. Does that sort of encompass what you're after?
Yeah, that's the spirit. I mean, that's the spirit of these books. Like, there was my favorite chapter, one of my favorite chapters in Outliers was the chapter where I entertain the idea that there was something in the culture that grew up around rice cultivation in Asia that has helped people from those same countries do really well in mathematics, that rice cultivation requires that you work insanely hard. There is no other form of agriculture that demands so much effort from you. So my theory, the idea was, wait, if you grew up in a world where for the last 1,000 years you're working twice as hard as farmers anywhere else, math's going to seem really easy, right? Because math is basically about how hard are you willing to work. Now, that is a piece, that argument is a piece of 100% speculation. I don't have any evidence for it. No one does. It's interesting, though. And it, even if it's not true, what it does is it gets you thinking about the ways in which culture and achievement intersect, which to my mind is one of the most interesting questions out there, right? So here we are in Utah. Look around you. You have two things going on in this state. One, you have a large number of Mormons, and you have an extremely successful business culture. Right? It is reasonable to assume that there is an intersection between those two things. Right? Now, can you do formal studies on this question and come to definitive answers? No. But you ought to think about that connection, because it's really, really interesting, and it matters for the rest of us, because we want to have successful business cultures in other parts of this country. And if there's something important going on in the intersection between the Mormon faith and the ability to do something meaningful in the business world, then I'd like to know what it is,
yeah.
Right? So you can't get anywhere unless you're willing to take a chance on ideas, right? And sometimes that means falling flat on your face when you go down a particular intellectual pathway and it ends in a dead end. But I'm fine. I'm fine with that. I don't have any. I'm quite happy to be wrong. I mean, it's almost as interesting to be wrong as right sometimes.
You've said you would. I think you put it this way. You wouldn't have been a writer if it weren't for your mother. And she'd written this. It's interesting. I didn't know about this. She'd written this memoir in 1969, the experience called Brown Face, Big Master. It's about her experience.
By the way, can we just pause and say, that's one of the greatest titles of all time. Now, I know it's my mother, but so Brown Face is her, Big yep. Master is God. In sort of Jamaican patois, God is called Big Master. So as a title for a book that's about her passage as a black woman and her relationship to God, it's a beautiful title, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway. My friends used to always joke that she should write a sequel called Browner Face, Bigger Master.
But I mean, you've talked about reading it, and which gave you a kind of a sense that, look, if my mother could pull this off, I could pull this off. I mean, was that part of it? I mean, what was the experience reading that
it was more the fact that I read it when I was very, very young. It was one of the first serious books that I ever read. And I remember marveling at the fact that this was an adult book and I could understand it. Because my mother writes very, very simply and clearly. And so this idea that it was a model for what writing is, and to this day, the single greatest compliment that anyone can pay me is when someone will come up and say, my 14-year-old or my 12-year-old read your book, is reading your book right now and likes it. The idea that you can communicate across a wide span of age range is, to my mind, that's one of the tests of effective writing. And my mother modeled that for me when I was very young. And I just remember being blown away by the fact that not only was it fascinating to learn about your mother's life when you're that age, any age, because my mother's actually weirdly a very private person. So she's, you know, and then, but also to be 9 or 10 and to be able to get a window on an adult world was just extraordinary.
She read you Bible stories. I guess, is this the first way you encountered David and Goliath? Was through your mother reading it to you?
My mother, yes. My mother and father both read to us. My mother, the story actually, I would make her read the story of David and Goliath, but more importantly, the story of Daniel in the lion's den. And I don't know why that story had such, they're both very, very similar stories, right?
Yeah.
They're about the power of faith in seemingly impossible circumstances. But that appealed to me. I mean, you know, it's funny, I had forgotten that until after I'd written this book, and I remembered how important those stories were to me as a child. So maybe this book is representing some kind of very deeply held ideas and memories.
Malcolm Gladwell. His new book is called David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. He was in Utah yesterday delivering the inaugural Sam Rich Lecture. It's a series hosted by the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics. We spoke to him from the Hinckley Institute. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Malcolm Gladwell. We recorded it yesterday afternoon in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. Gladwell was in Utah yesterday, the guest of the Hinckley Institute, and last night he gave the first speech in a new lecture series, the Sam Rich Lecture Series. His new book is David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. The final chapters in the book, you really come to this idea of faith. And this question, should I strike back or should I forgive? And the book deals a lot with the power of, I guess, the power of faith, or anyway, the idea of faith. I wonder, did that take you by surprise, that you would come around to the idea of faith when you were writing the book?
Yeah, that's not what I intended at all. I was very, very comfortably in the land of social science and studies and statistics and things. And when I encountered this woman, Wilma Dirksen, and I was interested in her because I had gone to see the guy who started the Three Strikes movement in California, who was someone whose daughter had been murdered brutally. And I had listened to him, and I had been struck by how much, even 20 years after the fact, he was still in pain. And I wanted to meet someone who had reacted to that. That's the worst thing that can happen to a human being, I think, is to have a child murdered. I wanted to find someone who had reacted in a different way. And so I learned about this woman, a Mennonite woman living in Canada. So I thought, oh, all right, I'll go and see her. She knew my sister-in-law. So I went to see her, just really on a, as much as that. I had barely even read about her case. So I get on a plane to Winnipeg, and I sit in the backyard of this little bungalow in a modest neighborhood of Winnipeg, and she tells me this extraordinary story about her daughter was abducted by this sexual predator, tortured, left for dead. They discover 3 days later her daughter's frozen body in a shed. And the first thing she and her husband do is stand up and say, we don't know who did this, but we are trying to find a way to forgive him. He needs our love. It brings tears to my eyes to this day. I can't. That is the single most extraordinary thing any human being has ever said to me. I can't imagine. It's insane. And where does she get the power to do that, right? Well, there's only one place you can get, no amount of, there is no explanation for that other than the power of religious faith, right? And you can't, and see, if you're going to write a book about where power comes from and how our notions of where power comes from are flawed, you have to end up with faith, because there's nothing more powerful than that. To be able to forgive the murderer of your, not just the murderer, the guy who tortured your daughter, to be able to do that that just threw the whole book into a kind of, just reordered it. I mean, it just kind of, it wasn't the same book after that. And that's why I ended with that story and another very similar story about the power of faith, because that's where you have to end up. If you start with David taking on the giant, you have to end with ordinary people who can do extraordinary things. Bizarrely, this book has been out for a month. The first round of responses to it from all of the big media outlets never once mentioned any of that. I couldn't believe it. I thought I'd written a book about faith. And you would think, reading some of the early, it's changed now. But I think a lot of people just weren't willing to go there. It's weird that discussion of faith in that context in 2013 is considered to be somehow strange in parts, you know, I don't know.
You talked about how in some ways the book, the faith part maybe, is starting to make you rethink your relationship with faith, bring you, I think you put it this way, bring you back to the fold of your family's faith.
Yeah. No, I come from a very religious background, and I had sort of drifted away, but I, that experience, it was impossible. You can't turn your back on something like that once you've, I guess what I had not found in my many years, and the reason I had drifted away is that I hadn't understood what it meant, what faith meant in a very tangible way. And then I saw it, you know.
It's interesting. You, I wonder what effect it has. It's interesting that you have this disclosure section. It's several pages on your website.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you disclose is just the fact that you believe in God. Like, it just sits there. I believe in God. It's one of those things. So I wonder how people relate to, or how does that affect the way people encounter your writing, or how does this idea, this disclosure that you're a believer?
I don't know how it...
But it's important to you to say it. It's important that people
know it. Yeah, I don't know how it... You have to say it. I don't know what it means for people. Clearly it does freak some people out, maybe. I don't know. Although, at the same time, you know, in America, of all places, people are more than accepting of that fact. They are, it's considered, you know, normal and a good thing in most places in America, just not in pages of certain magazines and newspapers. But generally, I don't think it's that odd of a thing in most places.
I'm not sure if you like can or want to talk about what are you thinking about these days? Do you talk about the projects that are on your mind these days? Yeah,
it's how you find out. My whole thing is the minute you start a new project, you have to talk about it because that's how you find out. Most cool stuff in an idea comes from you tell everyone. I'm the guy at the cocktail party who is just going on and on and on.
Right.
And then until you tell me something interesting that I can add to it. But I haven't quite. I mean, there are some things I'm sort of ideas I'm circling around. I got really interested in. I may write an article for the New Yorker about it. In tokenism. So sometimes this really interesting idea that, you know, sort of an obvious idea. Sometimes when we let someone in who's an outsider, it means we're going to let in everyone like that. Jackie Robinson is the first black baseball player, and then we open the door, and then we have lots of black baseball players. But sometimes when we let in the first person, it means that we're going to close the door, right? It's our justification for saying, I've done my part. Now I can hire no more of your kind, right? And I think that second thing, which is when the person you hire is not a pioneer but a token, is way more common. So you see tons and tons of examples where, if you look at all of the countries in the world that have had one and only one female head of state, it's this long. Most countries, they let one in and then they say, done, back to the guys, right? In the beginning, in the 30s, there were lots of famous, not lots, but several very, very famous female pilots. And everyone thought, that's going to mean that there's going to be lots and lots of female pilots in the future. There were no female pilots in the future. Door closed. Today, 7% of commercial airline pilots are women, right? So this is this weird case. Amelia Earhart is one of the most famous pilots of all time. She's in the 1920s. You'd think she's Jackie Robinson. She's not, right? So describing that mechanism, which is so important for understanding prejudice. That people think prejudice means I want none of your kind, but actually most of the time prejudice means I'll take one of your kind. Because then I can say, well, I'm not prejudiced, right? That there's something really deeply interesting in that dynamic. It's depressing. I don't know whether I want to write a book that's depressing, but The New Yorker will publish depressing articles. So that's one of the great things about it. You can just you can do something that's just a downer, and they're fine. They'll give you 8,000 words and say, keep going.
But you have fun with this, don't you? I mean, you seem to really love it.
I have fun sometimes. It's always terrifying to do something incredibly personal, like write a book, and then just loose it on the world. Because you don't know whether it's any good. You don't know whether people will like it. And also because there's a vicious strain in the culture now, which saddens me a lot, which you have to be very careful with, because it can affect you. People will, we've all seen it. Like, the online culture is not a pleasant place for someone who wants to do something, put something out there. But I enjoyed in the main. I've enjoyed this a lot.
Good.
So that's what matters.
Malcolm Gladwell. His latest book is David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. We spoke with Gladwell from the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics yesterday. He was in town to give the inaugural lecture in their Sam Rich lecture series. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Kirk Jowers, Jane Nelson, and Elsie Bali of the Hinckley Institute. Also thanks to Taylor Almond. Technical direction from KUER's engineer Lewis Downey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.